With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there and welcome to this extra special episode of the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm joined by the historian and writer Dominic Selwood to talk about his book Anatomy of a Nation, which is an exploration of British culture and identity over the last several millennia. And the book actually goes back to the very beginnings of Britain as a separate island nearly a million years ago. And we are going to explore everything from Brexit to the future of the British monarchy and the hopes and prospects of Britain as a unified nation state. Anyway, without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Dominic, and let's get a start with this fascinating and absorbing interview. Thanks very much. Okay, so welcome to the Explaining History podcast, Dominic Selwood. We're here to talk about Dominic's book, Anatomy of a Nation. And before we begin talking about the discussion that we were going to engage in today about what we can gain about understanding about sort of the identity of modern Britain, I'd like to begin by inviting you, Dominic, just to talk about the book and the project and how it came about, and a little bit about your kind of journey really through writing this.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Nick. Thanks for having me on the podcast. So the book really started because I wanted to write a history of Britain. But I wanted to do it in a slightly atypical way. I wanted to look at identity as one of the main themes about how we can think about the country. And I also wanted to use documents. And my thinking behind that was that there are lots of things one can use to examine the past. You know, there's archaeology, there's architecture. But I just find documents really specifically evocative because they can get you right back into the words and the thinking and the minds of people from different ages. And we often think that we don't really have documents going back to, you know, some of the times in the very distant past, but we really do. And so that was one of the joys of the book, really going back and finding personal things written by people, you know, as far back as the Roman period.
Sure.
Because I think we have so much that we think about in history that is official or state, government, wars, battles. But I'm really interested in the people and the stories and finding those from throughout history. And it really is possible. So, you know, from the lives of women in Roman times or medieval period. So that was really part of the thing.
So it's in a way partly an oral history of when in that sense.
Yeah, it's definitely a people history, people's history, yes, in that sense, totally. And then the question of identity just become really much more focused and fixed for me while I was writing it, because the Brexit debate started happening around me at the time, and so also did the culture wars and the statues wars.
Sure.
And this really focused for me what is happening in our country, what is at stake, what are we really arguing about. And it dawned on me really quite early on that, in as much as, you know, something like Brexit, it was framed as discussions about our future, in lots of ways, actually, they were you know, competing visions of our past.
Mm.
So a lot of that got folded into it. So I found it timely and fascinating to look into it, you know, in that period.
I mean, the past in any country in any given moment is contested, I would argue. There's no country in the world you can go to where I think there's a general consensus of, yes, well, this is who we are and this is what's happened, and I think we're all kind of in agreement on that. There is, you know, there's this old kind of Marxist dictum, isn't there, that, you know, class struggle is sometimes hidden, sometimes revealed. And I think cultural debates, if you will, or cultural struggles over identity, they're sometimes hidden, they're sometimes revealed, but they're always sort of ongoing. And I guess my question about the period we're in at the moment, you can call it the Brexit era, or I think it goes back before that, is why we've had this kind of renewed intensity of battles over identity. I think it predates 2016. But what are your thoughts?
I agree with you entirely. I think that Brexit is a symptom of a really quite profound malaise and identity crisis that we've been battling with really since the Second World War. And that is part of something that doesn't only afflict us. Actually, interestingly and tragically, if we look at what's happening in Russia and Ukraine at the moment, there are similar forces at stake, which is it's trying to find a role in a post-imperial world. And we have been trying to do it for most of the reign of Queen Elizabeth, really. And it's that trying to come to terms with the transition from, I mean, in the case of Britain, an entity that, you know, if you look at maps from the 1920s and 30s, you'll see that a quarter of the world is coloured pink.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're trying to understand how we fit in,
yeah,
as a modern country that's smaller than the state of Oregon and you know, and 10 other US states. And that's a difficult transition. And other imperial countries go through it too. But in our case, things like Brexit and things like the culture wars, I think, are very, very tightly mapped to that.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at European nations with kind of equivalent imperial histories, perhaps not on quite the same scale, but countries, say, for example, the Netherlands, you know, the Netherlands decolonized Indonesia just after the Second World War. It's just, you know, Indonesia's vast archipelago. The French went through a process of a much more bloody, protracted process of decolonization in Algeria and Vietnam and parts of Africa. It's hard to say, I suppose, whether they have more settled approaches to the past. The fact that there's a much more vigorous fascist movement in France right now than there has ever been in the United Kingdom at any point would suggest otherwise. And so one of the things I think Brexit has done is that it has, given the identity crisis is in Britain an outsized role in the world. It's been obviously been a very, very high profile thing, but I think it gives cover to other countries who have similar battles around identity. It allows those to go slightly below the radar, I think. But with your,
yeah, I think we have a particular tension, don't we? Every country is unique, but our unique tension is that historically, if you go back to the beginning of recorded history in this country, which is usually taken as the arrival of the Romans when writing arrived. From that period onwards, we have been one of those Western European countries that has perpetuated this idea of Romanitas, the Romanness that bound everything together, certainly for 1,000 years by the sort of church and Western ecclesiastical civilization. But then after the Reformation, we did something that other countries didn't do to such a great extent, which is that we created this Anglosphere, mm-hmm. at the heart of our various empires.
So then
when the Age of Empire ended, we had this split between our sense of ourselves as part of the Anglosphere and our sense of ourselves as part of Western European humanist tradition.
Yeah.
So when Winston Churchill at the end of World War II gave that very famous speech that called for the creation of the European Union, he said, this is what Europe has to do to stop itself from going back to war again, because the one thing we know about Europe is that throughout history it's completely excelled at is warfare. But he said, so Europe needs to do this. This is the way to prevent it happening again. But Britain will not be part of it, because Britain owes its, links its relations to the Anglosphere, that great, mm-hmm. Group of things. So already that dichotomy was there. And I think, we are feeling that, because when in listening to the Brexit debates or any of the conversations I'm sure, you have or we'll hear all the time, one really does hear that articulated, that sense of, well, we are a Western European country, but on the other hand, we have this slightly different, slightly Anglosphere type history. So those two tensions, I think, play for us particularly and cause difficulties.
Well, there's this really interesting thesis that Tony Judd put forward in his book Postwar. He said that Russia and Britain are sort of, they have a certain similarity in their relationship with Europe in that they both exist on its peripheries. And they are never, their identities as European countries are never quite settled. And there is, if you look in, from Peter the Great onwards, there is this Petrine tradition of, shall we be like Europe? Shall we build cities like St. Petersburg, which looked like Vienna and Stockholm and Berlin, or shall we be the Slavic Russian Eastern looking uniquely non-European people? And I guess in a very different way, there's still this tension of is Britain's world the Atlanticist world, is it this connection to Europe? And that debate has kind of run through Europe, run through kind of British post-war history. I mean, I think I doubt whether that dichotomy was what was motivating lots of people when they went to cast their polling cards in 2016. I think there are kind of deeper, more emotive things guiding people. To focus now for a moment on identity at the end of the second Elizabethan era, not to be too morbid, but there are the tabloid vultures are circling at the moment, and the Queen is 95 years old, and we are approaching what I think will be a very fundamental juncture in British identity. From it's the 70th year of the Queen being on the throne, so she's the longest reigning British monarch, and what has happened to Britain's sense of itself throughout that period, do you think?
I mean, the rain really quite encapsulates it very nicely, because she starts in 1952, so really in the immediate aftermath of World War II, and takes us up to the modern age, and that is the period in which I think Britain has changed so radically. And if one looks back to other periods in history, whether if one picks the sort of sub-Roman period or Viking period or Norman period, of course things always change and evolve. But the speed of change in her reign, the speed of change of the modern world, is just so vast. Britain in 1952 and Britain now really are almost unrecognisable places. And we can come on to talk about what that is, what those vast changes are. But I think it's happened so quickly that things like Brexit and things like the culture wars, they do allow people to sort of go back to the earlier part of her reign, because this is all within a lifetime.
Sure.
This is all within living memory. But it really is an unrecognisable country, both in terms of, in terms of so many things, in terms of economics, in terms of technology, in terms of culture, in terms of sort of DNA and people, in terms of its place in the world. Mm. All those things have changed so drastically and dramatically. And yet she is sort of been that one unchanging thing. She's quite a sort of security blanket, I think, in lots of ways, because mm-hmm. she sort of stands for this calm monarchy that sits over the top of all of it. But that, of course, is that's something that she personifies, and her father personified, her grandfather personified. But actually, before that, I mean, Victoria wasn't remotely Victorian. Edward the Seventh, the playboy king, so wasn't remotely Victorian either.
No.
So actually, we think of it as quite an old-fashioned view of monarchy, but in some senses, it's really quite a 20th-century monarchy. This was, George V and George VI, who both, as wartime kings, really felt the need to do their duty and be dignified images of service.
Yes.
Which is what she's really taken up and what she's really captured.
Yes.
So fascinating questions about where it goes next, because that by no means has always been the monarchy. That's
no.
definitely been a 20th century monarchy.
Well, I mean, I suppose if you look at the way in which the monarchy has shaped itself from Prince Albert onwards, I mean, he was a very clever kind of innovator of and understood the problems that a constitutional monarchy has in the 19th century, where it hasn't got a direct role in ruling, but needs to be able to justify its existence. And, Albert, this great patron of science and engineering and agriculture and all these other things that are transforming Great Britain at that time. The skill... that Albert, before his untimely death, demonstrated in helping the royal family to kind of navigate change. I think there are echoes of that throughout this kind of second Elizabethan age. The royal family and some fairly skilled advisors have been successful in some instances in saying, well, we need to present the royal family in this sort of a way, all the way down to having kind of meeting the public and having garden parties and things like that, appearing to be less remote. And then there have been certain catastrophic PR disasters, the death of Diana being the kind of the obvious standout one, where they've misjudged the public mood. And throughout it all seems to be that one thing, the growing role of the public as a determinant of the continuation of the royal family.
There has been vast social change in the way people think about Britain and their role and their part in it, and their relationship with the monarchy. I think that's absolutely true. If one thinks that sort of pretty early on in her reign, so what, from 52, but in 1960 we have the Lady Chatterley's lover trial.
Mm-hmm.
And that really brings into tight focus questions about the establishment and ordinary people, and whether there is a gulf between views.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly one of those who doesn't think that the trial in beginning of the 60s kicked off the 60s. I think actually it's the jury able to come to that view at that time. It's already a product of the 50s.
Sure.
The 50s was a decade of great optimism. It opens with the Festival of Britain. By 57, Macmillan is able to say, we've never had it so good. People are already continuing that journey, which starts at the beginning of the century, of actually moving away from the very rigid, hidebound, deferential sort of structures in Britain to something sort of much looser. So Elizabeth comes in at the beginning of that, although the old guard is still very, very much there.
Yeah.
And then we see in the Profumo affair, sort of 1961-63, leading to Wilson's resignation, that the country's actually quite shocked. By lots of it's not yet a completely sort of liberal place, but those currents are absolutely there. And so in the current Queen's reign, she has seen it change from really that still quite conservative but on the cusp of evolving country into now an extraordinarily liberal, forward-thinking, technological, multicultural society that is largely unrecognisable.
Well, part of often when I think about the transition from, say, the world my grandparents lived in, both who at the end of the Second World War, to the world, say, that I grew up in the kind of 1980s and 1990s, and the world that my son kind of inhabits now. And I think, well, what was the revolutionary fact, the revolutionary force? Because in a way, Britain has undergone a series of social and cultural revolutions in the second half of the 20th century. And it's my conclusion mainly is that mass consumer affluence has been the determinant. The reason why we are not shocked anymore when fairly regular Profumo level scandals occur, the reason why our attitudes about sexuality, immigration, with the exception of a few unpleasant kind of examples, have almost exclusively radically changed for the better. The reasons for the geographical and social mobility that people have, which is unprecedented, I put down to this development of mass consumer affluence that seems to have changed the world dramatically. What are your thoughts on that?
There's that lovely quote. I've got it in the book looking at the question of why didn't the communist revolution happen in Britain, as Marx and Engels had been sort of so convinced it would be, having come over and seen, the conditions in the factories, when Britain really was, the workshop of the world, and was exporting all of these things and developing these incredible infrastructure, railways and canals, at a human cost that, people still argue about, whether it was beneficial, whether it was not beneficial, whether people's lives are improved, whether they weren't, fascinating, we still don't know the answer to that. But that question also, why didn't in this country where there were so many workers treated, in those kinds of ways, why didn't the revolution happen here? And some wag journalist in the 50s said, the sound of Marx and Marx and Engels have been supplanted by Marx and Spencer.
Yeah.
And the sound of class warfare has been drowned out by the sound of the spin dryer. And the point really was that, Britain's workers and the unions have always been much more protective of the workforce rather than militant. Of course, there have been examples, but in general, there's that. So I agree with you. I think British society did become very wrapped up in consumerism, and that has an effect because on the whole, it makes people more comfortable.
Yeah.
It doesn't, of course, happen in a vacuum. We see this happening in lots of other parts of the world as well, which is why the world, all modernises together. It wasn't just Britain that was modernising.
Yeah.
But I think Britain kind of has a way of not doing things by halves, and it did consumerise very 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 comprehensively. And that is one of the reasons for significant change. Yeah.
Well, this is. I mean, I agree with you, and I think the kind of the relative degree of political consensus and I won't use the word harmony because it's not always been harmonious, but the fact that Britain has historically managed to avoid, you know, mass parties of political extremes on either side has got a lot to do with the fact that you know, Britain is an old capitalist society, by which I mean that the kind of the processes of globalization that led to growing material affluence in Britain have been over the period of about 150 years. And what has happened?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
During that time is that liberal capitalism, if you go all the way back to the debates over free trade throughout the 19th century, to the majority of the population, liberal capitalism has made more of a sense than its revolutionary alternatives. Revolutions, you know, Marxist-Leninism was possible in Russia because of the collapse of the state, you know, because and it becomes, there's a revolutionary window in places like Germany in 1919 because of the crisis of the state. And had Britain lost the First World War, perhaps the story would have been different. But these things kind of exist within a context. And you're right about the trade unions, in that most trade union militancy in Britain has been to enable British workers to have a bigger slice of, you know, the returns of capitalism, as opposed to, you know, smashing the system, putting the bourgeoisie up against the wall, and come the glorious day and all that. So this sort of what we experience, this relatively, and I say relatively because that in, you know, there are numerous examples where this isn't the case, relatively kind of consensual society that of the last 50 or 60 years does have like historical roots. It's not just because there's something exceptionally wonderful about British people in our kind of moderate ways.
No, I think that's right. And two things from that, actually. One is that in terms of our sense of, well, where do we go after the loss of empire? I think absolutely folded into that also is, where do we go after the loss of our industry? Mm-hmm. Because actually, you know, the Industrial Revolution and empire are coterminous, and they're so closely bound up with each other.
Yeah.
That Britain's sense of itself and what it's doing and one of its roles in the world is very linked in with industry and mass production. And so now that industry has gone, that also, and sort of the nostalgia for industry and the industry as was, and the great sort of, you know, production house of Britain, I think that's very bound in with the sense of loss after empire as well, and the sense of direction. Well, how do we make our way in a world where these are sort of service economies? But the other thing, the harmony, yes, but also no on some levels. One of the things that I concluded after looking at Britain throughout all of these ages is that actually we're incredibly tribal. Yes, we're violent. I mean, the first document in the book is axes and daggers on Stonehenge. And really, there isn't a period in British history when there isn't some extraordinary battle going on of one sort or another that is defining of the nation's identity. And, you know, poor schoolchildren have to wrestle with this all the time. I mean, it's just battle after battle after battle. Mm-hmm. And most of them are significant in one way or another. You know, beneath that, I think at a societal level, when you think of the fact that, you know, so many parliaments around the world are you know, beautifully arrayed in sort of amphitheatres or semicircles or you know, it's just something that's trying to create an architectural plea for unity finding some way forward together, compromise. Actually, we still love this, you know, sort of neo-Gothic chamber where we can shout and jab at each other across a central aisle. And, you know, courts, again, I mean, the legal system, we still have this adversarial legal system. I mean, it's jolly effective. Mm. You know, but other countries, their sort of inquisitorial system is a little bit different. I think we do have tribalism built deep into Britain. And, you know, lots of British people, if you meet them, the one thing that they really love doing, you know, sooner or later, is, you know, defining themselves by who they're not or who they're against or what they find really objectionable.
Yeah.
So there is an element of oppositionality, I think, in the British psyche as well.
I think if you're looking at Britain in the long term, obviously, you know, Britain itself, the, you know, United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and before that, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, and before that, Great Britain. These are constructs, and they have a period of they have a lifespan, and so looking at Britain, and you go back, you know, really to the very beginnings of life on the British Isles, it sort of almost depends which Britain you're talking about, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the places where I try to go with the book, to say, well, if we're lost now, and I think we are, where do we go next? And the temptation is to say, well, look, we have to either resurrect this Churchillian, keep calm and carry on, slightly sort of, you know, dying days of the empire Britain, you know, or we have to slot in with the European Union and do the consensual continental thing. But actually, if you look back at history, I think we don't do that. We find completely new things. And if you look at the transitions from Roman to sub-Roman to Anglo-Saxon to Viking to Norman to more French, then there's more English identity emerging after the Hundred Years' War, then to the Tudors, and then the Reformation, of course, is of Protestant identities, and then Hanoverians again changing things entirely by bringing this whole, you know, Germanic feel at least into the sort of the court and government, you know, all the way through into the 20th century with the you know, mass immigration of the sort of, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s. Actually, the identities that we move between, they very rarely, when there's a point of conflict, come down one side or the other on what was before. They come up with something actually quite stunningly new.
Yeah.
So my sense is that we will find a way forward from this. It's not going to be quick, but it's unlikely to be one of the historic identities. I think we can be inspired by our historic identities and draw real comfort from the fact that we do very, very radically different things. I mean, we have been so many different... actually genuinely different countries. The names have changed, but even if we, as a kind of blunt tool, say the name is the same, actually what's going on underneath and internally is incredibly different. Speaking different languages, looking in different directions, yeah. Sometimes looking across the Atlantic, sometimes looking to Scandinavia, sometimes looking to France. So yes, I think the new identity will not be one of the old ones. It will be something that fits for the 21st century in a modern world whose problems are very different to the problems of the past.
Well, there's a fantastic book, if you've read it, David Edgerton's Rise and Fall of the British Nation. And his view of what Brexit signifies, he says, you know, at the end of the Second World War, we ceased being a kind of, well, you know, within the decade afterwards, ceased being an imperial power. And the new conception of Britishness was this was a more nation-centric, self-sufficient nation state, and that kind of by the 1970s has lost its way. The joining the EU or the EEC as it was at the time, and then Margaret Thatcher's really sort of sort of plugging Britain through things like the deregulation of the stock market and the Big Bang and the kind of the opening up of Britain and relaxing of various controls, really kind of plugging Britain much more fundamentally into globalisation, ended that conception of the nation, and that sort of, you know, muddles along till 2008, and there's this big financial crisis, and then in 2016, bang, there's this big essentially nationalist explosion. And after 2016, no, as you're saying, no settled state about the nature of British identity and nationhood has re-emerged. I mean, one possibility, as we see a kind of an overall decline in people's faith in institutions, one possibility certainly is Scottish independence. Whether that happens or doesn't, there's a significant chance of it, and the possibility of reunification of the of Northern Ireland with the Irish Republic, the kind of the overall sort of rise of nationalisms within the United Kingdom. Obviously, that's not a post-Brexit thing either. This is, you have to look back to the 1970s to see the emergence of the Scottish Nationalist Party, and slightly even earlier to look at here in Wales the development of Plaid Cymru.
The various interrelationships between Wales, Scotland, Ireland and England are fascinating over the historical period, because as entities within themselves, they have remained. I mean, one can point to definitive Welsh, Irish, Scottish and English cultures, you know, for most of that period. So there has actually been real consistency, you know, so amongst the building blocks of the UK, as it were, over time. What's fascinating is the very different combinations of independence, codependence, and union that have been found between those four blocks.
Yeah.
Over the periods, and you're right. We're going into a period when, along with everything else, that is being thrown up in the air again. I mean, the Scotland question is very real.
Sure.
As is the Irish, both simmering along in their own ways, but also very much catalysed now by Brexit.
Sure. I think many Scots and Irish can look at Brexit and say that this is essentially an English nationalist project. And the voting in Wales, that would suggest that there was some majority in Wales for Brexit, but certainly the majority of voters appear to have been English voters.
In the marches. Yeah.
So this is this places a huge, possibly a huge pressure on the union. I think people that imagine that either of those changes are a done deal are getting a bit ahead of themselves. But they're both more likely than they were, I would say.
I mean, when you say it's an English nationalism, and it's also quite amusing. I remember sitting listening to debate one day, listening to when the Take Back Control slogan came out, and realising actually that take is Old Norse, back is German, control is French, and so it might be an English movement. But you know, the history of Britain is so intertwined with these other cultures that we couldn't even express a desire to separate ourselves from Europe without using three European words. I think joking aside, the degree of interconnectedness is something that shouldn't be underplayed historically.
Sure. And I think there was a thing that David Reynolds argued when he said that the union itself had been given throughout the 20th century a kind of a prolonged lifespan by the factors of two world wars and a Cold War. Having these external crises, he said basically, at the end of the Second World War, you might have had a generation of Scots, Welsh, and Irish people thinking, "Well, I've no love for the English, but we served the king, and we marched under the Union flag into battle, and you know, we have a loyalty and an identity in that sense. But he was saying that since the end of the Cold War, these kind of external threats have been lessened, and that in itself has kind of weakened these internal bonds holding the nations together. And I just wonder, as we're going into a period of history perhaps that nobody will be able to chart for the events in Ukraine and what that means for events around the world, maybe the Union has dodged another bullet there.
Weakened but also strengthened, isn't it? I mean, weakened and it's become more amorphous in lots of ways. But within individual viewpoints, there's often a resilience and a robustness now that will brook with no dissent or discussion either way.
Yeah.
So it's the two of those almost move in parallel.
Yes. Yes. But you know, it's easy to speculate about the future. So when you look at the themes that run through the book from kind of beginning to end, are there things that in your journey through the history of Britain that you could say are kind of constants that you can identify?
I was looking for things. It's quite hard because, you know, what sort of sub-Roman Celtic Britain and, you know, Stuart Britain have in common. I mean, it's tricky because they are entirely different places with different people and different focuses.
Hmm.
So one's not going to be able to come up with some sort of great overarching thesis of what Britain has always been. But I think I did find two things that sort of consistently stood out. One is that for vast periods of its history, Britain has managed, and I'm not saying other countries don't do this, but Britain has often managed to be very creative.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, let's go back to Anglo-Saxon times and book production, for example. Anglo-Saxon books were some of the most valued in Europe. There was an incredible tradition of bookmaking, of literature, of writing, of thinking, not just the sort of, you know, the Lindisfarne Gospels and the Great Bibles and the Book of Kells and so on, but you know, just sort of scholarly thought and contributing to that great sort of, you know, whirlpool of thought that was, you know, sort of the medieval intellectualism. So, you know, that kind of creativity, you know, Beowulf, stories like that. I mean, these are incredibly creative and capture the imagination and did of people abroad as well. So in most periods, we can find incredible creativity, whether it's in literature, whether it's in theatre, whether it's in design, whether it's in engineering and the Industrial Revolution, whether it's in, you know, music or, you know, Sex Pistols and dressing up and, you know, all those kind of things. There seems to be a constant of creativity that catches the attention of many other nations or the rest of the world, you know, depending on the period. And so I think people do look at Britain and see that creativity. I think another thing is actually the gifted amateur and the dilettante, because so many of the things that one thinks of, you know, sort of British discoveries or great British things, whether it's, you know, some of the typefaces that people read all around the world every day, you know, invented by people like, you know, Baskerville, who was a Japanner, or Caslon, who was a, you know, gun engraver, or the World Wide Web, you know, Berners-Lee kind of invented it by accident while he was creating a phone directory. There are so many of these things that really do mark the world and that sort of are British contributions are done by people in their spare time. And I think that's also quite a British thing. We don't like the serious intellectual or the serious person who's trying really hard to do something. The Enlightenment, for example, you know, Bacon, Locke and Newton, I mean, these people, you know, grounded the Enlightenment. There would then be so many different Enlightenments in so many countries. But they're absolutely not like, you know, the French philosophes, this kind of, you know, really venerable group of people that everyone holds up and esteems. They're, well, I mean, for a start, you know, I mean, doctors, politicians, lawyers who just happen to have an interest in experimental science and come up with these things. So yeah, so I think creativity and gifted amateurs and dilettantes.
Cool. Well, we have a habit of voting for them. Fabulous. Well, Dominic, I think we'll draw things to a close there. And thank you so much for agreeing to have a chat with us today. So, Anatomy of a Nation, is it in print at the moment? Is it coming out? What's the date?
Yes, it was out in September last year.
Okay.
In the UK. It came out in the US a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
And it'll be in paperback in the UK in September.
Fabulous. Available in all good bookshops, and I will put a link to the book in the video and podcast notes below. Thank you so much, Dominic, and I do hope you'll pop back at some point and we can talk about matters of identity and culture some more.
I'd love to, Nick. Thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
All right. Take good care. All the best.
Great. Cheerio.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.